Good morning. The last couple weeks we've been looking at the Jewish sects, and we've taken a look thus far at the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And today we're going to pick up with a third group that we know of not from the Bible, but from world history, and that is the Essenes. And so just like we did with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, we'll take a little look at their origin, where they came from, and then a little bit about them and their belief system. We don't know about the Essenes from the Bible. They're not mentioned in the Bible, but we do know about them from secular historians. There's three main sources of our knowledge of this group of people. And the first is Philo, and he actually refers to them in a couple of his works. Josephus, who I'll mainly be drawing on Josephus today, he has most of the detail. But also the historian Pliny the Elder. We know things about the early Christian church from Pliny as well, but he's one that also mentions the Essenes. So those are the three main sources of our history of this group. Similar to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the origin of the name Essene is unclear. There's debates about what it means. I'm not even going to get into it because it's even less clear than the derivation of the Pharisees or the Sadducees. So we don't really know what Essene means or where it comes from. But it basically was an ascetic movement that began in the early 2nd century B.C. Josephus mentions the Essenes at the same point that he mentions the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Again, if you remember, that was during the reign of Jonathan, one of the Maccabean brothers. So we're in the early 2nd century B.C. That's the first historical reference we have to the Essenes. So most people believe that the Essenes were successors also of the Hasidim. So we talked about the Hasidim earlier, how they were the pious ones that resisted the Hellenization movement, and the Pharisees most likely were their spiritual successors. And so many believe that the Essenes were also successors of the Hasidim, but then they developed in a more conservative direction than the Pharisees. So if you think of like a family tree, you'd have the Hasidim as sort of the predecessors, and then two branches coming off of there, the Pharisees in one direction and the Essenes in the other direction. So I have a number of various statements and quotes here that I'll just read from different scholars on this and what they say so you can get a feel for the theories that are out there. This man, Avi Yonah, says, "The Hasidim were supplanted by the Pharisees and the Essenes." So that's what I was just talking about there. Another scholar by the name of Lasore says that the Essenes may have actually derived from the Pharisees. So in that line of thinking, you'd have the Hasidim, the Pharisees would have been successors, but then the Essenes would have split off from the Pharisees. Another scholar I've used quite a bit in this course, Forster, argues that the Essenes followed the Teacher of Righteousness in a break with the temple. The Teacher of Righteousness is a figure that's associated with the Qumran community. He argues that they followed this Teacher of Righteousness in a break with the temple into a monastic direction, a monastic separation, while the Pharisees would have remained in Jerusalem in the temple worship. So that's another potential split there. And then Russell, who's another, D.S. Russell is another scholar I've used a lot in this course and quoted a lot. He says, "It's generally agreed that the Essenes ancestry is to be found in those pious ones, that is the Hasidim." So there's a consensus that they go back to the Hasidim. Exactly how they branched off from there, we're not exactly sure. Now, something interesting happened in 1947 when the Dead Sea Scrolls were unearthed. There were a lot of connections that were begun to be made between the community in Qumran and then what we knew about the Essenes from the secular historians. And so I'd like to talk for a minute about the relationship of the Essenes to the Qumran community. It's likely that they were closely related. One reason we think they're very closely related is Pliny the Elder, in his writing, he describes a community of Essenes. So he's talking about the Essenes, but he talks about them as a community in the vicinity of where we know the Qumran community was, near the Dead Sea. So it matches very closely with what we know about the community of Qumran now that we've unearthed the Dead Sea Scrolls and all of their manuscripts, as well as done excavations at Qumran. The scholar Lasore that I mentioned earlier believes that even though there are definite similarities between the two, it's not possible to equate the two communities. They may have derived from a common Jewish sect. And F.F. Bruce concluded that Qumran may have been one branch of the Essenes, which there were at least four different varieties that have been identified of Essene belief systems and groups. So he concludes that the Qumran community may have been one branch of those groups. He says, a reasonable conclusion is that the Qumran community was one Essene group, diverging in several particulars from other Essene groups. One of the things we know about the Essenes is that they were scattered throughout the towns. They were just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They weren't necessarily in one location. So it's possible that the Qumran community was one of those Essene groups. One of the things that makes it difficult to figure out about the Essenes when you're reading, especially in the secondary sources, because of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, a lot of people have made that connection and have just assumed that the Qumran people were Essenes. Sometimes in the secondary sources, when you're trying to read about the Essenes, you start to find a lot of things imported to the Essene community that are really found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's sometimes, you know, it's sort of assumed that they're the same, and so they say the Essenes must have believed all these things that we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, that's possible, but it's not necessarily true. So you just have to be a little bit careful about that, about what's being read into the Essenes. So who were these people? What did they believe? You'll find a lot of similarities in the beliefs of the Pharisees with the Essenes, which you might expect if these two groups kind of developed alongside one another or even out of one another. They have a strong emphasis on the sovereignty of God. You remember that that was one of the marks of the Pharisees' beliefs, that they believed in providence and the fact that God was in control of all things. We find that also with the Essenes. The way Josephus puts it is that all things are best ascribed to God. That is, God is behind everything that happens. And so you might think that they have a strong view of fate that goes along with that. And remember, fate is a term that Josephus uses, probably more similar to the way we would use providence today. Not fate like Greek fate, but more like providential fate. Josephus's comment here seems to indicate that the Essene view of fate was even stronger than the Pharisees. Remember, the Pharisees had some room for the doctrine of free will, so there was freedom of the will, and yet God was in control of everything. It's hard to say, but he uses stronger language about the Essenes' view of fate, so it's possible that they may have been more determined as a philosophy rather than having a doctrine of free will. Just like you might expect, they believed in the immortality of the soul. This one's a little confusing because we get a little bit of conflicting information here. Josephus, if you read Josephus about the Essenes, he sort of indicates that they viewed the body as something to be escaped from. You know, and then so when you hear that, you immediately think of Greek philosophy and Platonism and Neoplatonism, where the body is a prison and we want to escape from the body. But Hippolytus, who was one of the early Christian writers, indicates that they did believe in a bodily resurrection, and those things don't usually go together. If you want to escape from the body, according to Greek philosophy, it's not good to be put back in a body at the resurrection. So it's a little confusing here. I think Josephus is probably, you know, there's a sense in which we understand that because of our fallenness and the ills of this life and the suffering and stuff, there is a sense that you could say that you want to escape from the body. As Christians, we want to escape from this body to put on our new bodies in the resurrection. It's possible that Josephus was just referring to that rather than importing Greek philosophy in here. Yes, Pastor. Well, the comment was that it's possible if from the outside people looking in, if they see this very strict discipline and discipline of the body, that they might interpret that as wanting to escape from the body. One thing we do know, Josephus tells us that they were willing to undergo horrible tortures to the death by the Romans. He even says that they did it with disdain. So why would you do something like that? Well, not necessarily because you want to escape from the body, but because you believe in the resurrection. You believe that this life isn't all there is. You can kill my body, but you can't kill my soul kind of thing. So that's an interesting thing that Josephus mentions about them. And then you might expect if they believed in immortality, they believed in rewards of the righteous. So you see a lot of similarities between the belief systems of the Essenes and the Pharisees. That's sort of all I have to say. That's really all we know about their belief system. Move on here to some of the characteristics of the Essene sect. One question we might ask is, why aren't they mentioned in the New Testament? the New Testament has a lot to say about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now, there's been various ideas put forth here. Probably the most likely thing is that they were a monastic community that had retreated from public life. And, you know, when the Bible is talking about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, it's not giving us, it's not like we're looking up in an encyclopedia who the Pharisees and the Sadducees were. They're always presented in the context of a story for a purpose, a teaching purpose. And because the New Testament is recording history, it's just recording what happened. You know, Jesus rubbed shoulders with Pharisees and Sadducees. It's possible he never rubbed shoulders with Essenes because they were retreated from public life. They weren't participating in the temple worship. And so it's probably the most logical explanation. Whiston, who is the scholar that translated the big book of Josephus that I use, he speculates that it was because they were excluded from the temple worship. And we know that from Josephus also. According to Josephus, the Essene group, apparently, they offered their own sacrifices, not in the temple. They had withdrawn from the temple because they believed that the priesthood was corrupt. So they had some kind of system, we don't exactly understand it, where they offered their own sacrifices. And so Josephus says, quote, "They are excluded from the common court of the temple." So that's just another reason why we might not find them in the New Testament. They weren't participating in the worship in the temple. And a lot of the action in Jerusalem is happening in the temple area. So that's possibly why we don't know of them from the New Testament. They were a monastic order. They studied the scriptures very diligently. They often found, here we're importing a little bit from the Dead Sea Scrolls, but a lot of the scholars say that they found symbolic meaning and they had future predictions. Well, how do we know that? We don't have writings from the Essenes. We have writings from the Dead Sea Scrolls that have those type of characteristics. So, and we saw some of those, the symbolism, the symbolic meaning, and the future eschatological views and predictions that were made when we looked at the intertestamental literature. So it's likely that the Essenes had that type of view. Now, Philo estimated that there were some 4,000 members of this party. So, you know, that kind of gives you an idea of how many there were. They lived, as I mentioned earlier, they lived throughout the villages and the cities. They didn't live in one particular location. Now, Josephus gives us a lot of information about their initiation process. So this was a monastic order that was very, very strict. It was very difficult to join them. So they had this two-stage initiation process, which took about 3 years. So you had to be pretty well committed to get in to go through this process. It was broken into two stages. The first year, Josephus tells us, was an initiation period, probably like a testing out period to make sure they were serious. And if they survived the first year of initiation, they would undergo what he calls the washing of the purification waters. So some kind of a sprinkling or a baptism to show that they were ready to take the next step in joining the order. After that, then there was another 2-year probationary period, which I'm not going to go into all the details, but they would participate more with the community, but they still were not able to eat the communal meal, which was the real gathering when you were really a member of the community and you were allowed to eat the communal meal with everyone. If you passed that additional 2-year period, you were ready for full initiation. And then at that point, they would take very strong oaths of joining the community. The oaths involve things like oaths of piety to God, justice to all of your fellow men, fidelity to the authorities, which is interesting. We'll see that that is a different view from that of the zealots who did not have fidelity to the authorities. But fidelity to the authorities, a lot of moral oaths for personal purity and things like that. And then secrecy of doctrines. So they did have this inner secrecy of the doctrines that they were sworn to preserve. And they took these oaths very seriously. And one way we know that is because Josephus tells us what would happen if somebody was cast out. So they had discipline, and if somebody had a problem, they had a process for sort of excommunicating them out of the order. And Josephus tells us that if somebody was cast out of the order, they often became destitute and starved because they had taken these oaths to not receive help from any other person outside of the order and all of this stuff. And he tells us that often they would get to the point of starvation and then they would let them back in again so they didn't die. So that shows you how seriously they took the oaths. Even when they were cast out, they still felt that they were bound by those oaths to not take help from anyone outside the order. They were a communal community, as you might expect. They shared everything in common. They were very merciful to one another. And they had an aesthetic and sober lifestyle. This is one of the things that Pastor was mentioning earlier. A lot of self-discipline. So Josephus tells us quite a bit about this in his two books. He says that they rose before dawn to pray. So they had an early prayer session before dawn. Then they would work all day with the exception of a break for lunch. And he has an interesting quote here. He says, "They think to be sweaty a good thing." So they were hard workers. Now, that doesn't mean that they were dirty. They actually were very ceremoniously clean. So they had ritual washings. They bathed in cold water, we're told. And then when they would have these meals, their lunch and their communal meals, it was very orderly. They would put on these white linen garments. They would all file into the mess hall, have their meals very soberly and quietly, and then go back to work again. We know that, just like you might expect with some of these communities, they used medicinal herbs and stones for health purposes. And Josephus tells us that they despised riches, as you might expect, but he goes to the point of telling us that they wear out their clothes. So they use their clothes until they're all the way gone, completely worn out. The question of celibacy is an interesting one with the Essenes. What we gather is that they were generally celibate, but not as an absolute course, not as a requirement, more as a desired course. Probably this might be the case that there were the different branches of the Essenes had different views on celibacy. If they were a celibate community, one of the things that's discussed in the literature is how did they grow if they were a celibate community. A lot of their numbers came from outside, so people would leave Jerusalem and want to come and join the order, and so they would come as adults or young men. We're told that they also raised other people's children in their ways. This almost sounds like, you know, like when Samuel was brought to the temple and was dedicated to the temple and was raised by the priests there. It seems like there was a lot of that type of thing going on where people would come and give their children to the group of people and they would raise them in their ways, very strict and disciplined. And then Josephus tells us that they exceed all others in virtue and righteousness. So they reject pleasures as evil. They were very self-controlled over their passions. They saw that as a virtue. And he tells us that their word is as good as any oath. So whatever they say holds true, regardless of whether they've taken an oath or not. And he says that they were very self-disciplined in the way they used their mouths. Their speech was very self-disciplined. He has an interesting comment here in his book, Wars of the Jews. He says, "Their silence appears to foreigners like some tremendous mystery." So you can imagine the people coming in to visit and it's just a lot of silence. And he tells us that that's kind of the way that the meals were when they would come in. It was very sober and very quiet when they were eating. So we get the view of the Essenes as a monastic community that is really self-disciplined, rejecting the pleasures of the world and withdrawing from the world and withdrawing from the worship in the temple in Jerusalem. So that's all I have to say about the Essenes. Any comments or questions about them? Yes, Jay. The question is regarding celibacy and were there women involved. Here's an example of where we don't know much about the Essenes in particular from the historical sources. We know a lot more about the Qumran community, and we know that there were women in the Qumran community. There's graveyards that have been uncovered in that area. And there are women buried there. So I think a lot of what we're saying about the Essenes here is importing a little bit, assuming that the Qumran community was probably a group of Essenes, and we learned from that that there were women there, there were children. Not a lot, but there were some. It was mainly male, but there were women involved. And this may be one of the, you know, if there were different branches of the sect, some of them may have been celibate, some of them may not have been celibate and had wives and children. So it's kind of hard to say, but that's what we know about Qumran, at least. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Jen. No, I think you were maybe out when I was talking about that, but they're not mentioned in the Bible. There's been monastic-type communities back into ancient history of all different stripes, so it's hard to make any connection there, I think. Yeah, Daniel. That's possible. And Paul would probably have known about these communities as well. So this is something that the monastic movements always wrestle with, right? Is it good to be married? Because that can be a distraction from serving the Lord, which is, I think, where Paul's coming from there as well. Where it makes sense, if it's good for you, go ahead. But if it's good for you to remain single, that's fine too. Yeah, Jen. Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah, that's right. And New Horizons has articles on singleness in the last issue. TJ. There's no tie here to the Christian community. This is strictly a movement within Judaism. So if you think about the movements, you got the Sadducees, who would be on the very liberal political side, and then you've got the Pharisees, who were the main conservative party within Judaism. And then you have a group further to the right then, the Essenes, would have been sharing a lot of the belief systems with the Pharisees, but wanting to go further in, you know, we don't accept this temple worship as legitimate. We're not really happy about having Roman overlords and stuff, and we're going to retreat outside the temple worship. Yes, Pastor. Yeah, that's a good question. What was their view of Scripture? We're not told in the sources anything about their view of Scripture. We have to go look at Qumran again, and we know a lot about Qumran's view of Scripture. They had the entire Old Testament. They had a scriptorium where they were diligently copying the Scriptures. So we think that they had a high view of Scripture. Now, what was their view of oral tradition? Assuming that they're a derivative or tied somehow to the Pharisaical party, I think it's probably a good assumption that they would have held to the oral tradition as well. And we see the other writings in Qumran, like the Manual of Discipline, and I forget all the other ones that they had there, but they had other writings that were pretty authoritative for their community. So, you know, it's hard to exactly to say, but we do know they had a high view of Scripture because they were interested in preserving it and copying it. But it's hard to say much beyond that, I guess. Any other questions or comments about the Essenes? Interesting group of people. Okay, well, with that, I'll turn to the last of the sects, if you can call this a sect. This is the Zealots. This is a curious group. We don't know much about them. You know, it's even debated whether we should call them a sect. The other three are clearly spelled out as having belief systems, characteristics, and Josephus even tells us in his early days that he went and tried out all three of these. So there definitely were these boundaries if you were, you know, going to become one of these parties. The Zealots isn't really like that. They may have been a broad category of people that ranged all the way from very strong religious conservatives all the way across to just bandits and criminals who wanted to overthrow Rome and anywhere in between. When we hear the word zealot, it's not exactly clear which of those people, you know, where they are and maybe the spectrum. Josephus does call them a sect. He says there's a fourth sect, is exactly what he says. He ties this to a man named Judas the Galilean. He says it's the sect of Judas the Galilean. And he doesn't, see, this is where we're groping a little bit. He refers to the fourth sect, the sect of Judas the Galilean, but he doesn't say that they're zealots. But most likely he's referring to what we know elsewhere as the zealots. Now, when I say the sect of Judas the Galilean, I don't know if that rings any bells with anybody, but Judas the Galilean is actually mentioned in the Bible, and I'll take you to that passage in Acts chapter 5. This is when the apostles were brought on trial. Remember, Gamaliel gave a speech. Remember, they're trying to figure out what to do with the apostles, and he's basically referring to these other leaders that rose up, had followers, and then were dispersed. And one of the ones he mentions is Judas the Galilean. So in Acts chapter 5, verse going down to 37, he says, "After him," this is that guy Thutis he was talking about, "but after him, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt. He too was killed, and all his followers were scattered." So this is likely the same Judas the Galilean that Josephus refers to as sort of the head of the sect of the Zealots. And most of the secondary scholars that I read make that connection as well. He places Judas's rise at the time of the removal of Archelaus. So you remember, Archelaus was the son of Herod, who ruled in Herod the Great's place. And he didn't rule very long, from 4 BC to 86, and he was removed by the Romans. So Josephus puts Judas's rise around when Archelaus was removed from power. There was a lot of political stuff going on at that time, you can imagine. The Jews were sending delegations to Rome to have Archelaus removed. The Roman authorities came in and actually removed him, and they were setting up sort of this temporary government till they figured out what they were going to do. And, of course, they eventually appointed a Roman procurator to rule the area. But Josephus has a lot to say about all the turmoil that was happening at that time. And so it's very natural that if you were bent on revolting, it would have been a very opportune time to lead a revolt when everything was sort of in chaos and there wasn't really anybody in charge as a king anymore. That makes sense, I think, to me. Although Judas is not called a zealot here in the New Testament, he probably at least represented the ideas of the zealots that we do know about. So what do we know about the zealots? What were their characteristics? Well, they would have been similar to the Maccabees of the earlier generations, people who are willing to take up arms to resist the power of the authorities that were over them. They were anti-Herodian. That means, you know, remember the house of Herod, and then we've got the successors of Herod that we went through earlier and the way that the different places they were ruling. They were very anti-Herodian, and they also were largely from Galilee. So that's another tie-in here, Judas the Galilean. A lot of people think he, you know, that he probably was one of the founders of this movement. So Josephus gives a brief description of these people. He says they serve God alone as their ruler, and they have an inviolable attachment to liberty from men. So basically that means they're willing to take up arms and they're willing to lay down their lives so that they don't have any ruler other than God. They agree with all the notions of the Pharisees, the belief system, and they disdain death and are ready to die for their cause. Forster, another of the scholars that I mentioned earlier, has a little bit more to say about them. He says that probably they were another split from the Pharisees during the time of Herod, agreeing with the Pharisees that God and his will were to be obeyed exclusively, but disagreeing on how to respond to the Roman authority. Pharisees being subject to them and trying to remain on good terms with them for the most part. The zealots wanting to overthrow the rule of Rome. They rejected at all costs every ruler over Israel except God himself. They refused to pay taxes to Caesar. Kind of goes along with it. Violence resistance is justified. And then Forster has this quote, and I'll read this here. This movement produced prophet after prophet who spoke of the imminent fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies and gave rise time and again to men who believed themselves called to lead the Jews against the pagan world power of Rome. And so this could have been, you know, even the succession of rebels here that Gamaliel is referring to. Whenever the time was opportune, there was always a leader who could rise up, gather a band of followers to resist and try to overthrow the Roman authority. So that's pretty much all we know about the zealots. Turning to the Bible, the term is used in the Bible. The Apostle Simon, you remember, is called the zealot. What does that mean? It's hard to say. Probably on the religious zealot side rather than the political side, if he was attracted to following Jesus' teachings. We have an interesting comment in one of Paul's interactions in Acts 21. This is when Paul was arrested, and there was the mob scene in the temple area, you remember, and Paul speaks to the crowd. And when he talks to the soldier, remember, he speaks to the soldier in Greek and says, "May I say something to you?" And the guy says, "Oh, do you speak Greek?" And he says, "Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" I don't know if you've ever read that. Why would he assume Paul is an Egyptian who led 4,000 people on a terrorist mission? I don't know what to make of the term Egyptian there, but the term that is used here in the Greek for terrorists is a term that Josephus uses for a group called the Assassins. And the Latin term is the Sicarii. Josephus calls these people the Sicarii, and he tells us a lot about them, that they were people who were kind of working behind the scenes to try to knock off people that they thought were not following Judaism properly. He actually tells us that during the times when there were many people crowded into the temple area, these people would go amongst the crowd with daggers and actually stab people. They would target people that they thought were not following the ways of their fathers and actually kill them. And it's interesting that the term used here for these terrorists by the Roman soldier here is the same term that Josephus uses. So there was this zealot movement of people that were actually willing to kill other people who they thought were threats. And then, of course, the zealots were the ones that would have led the revolt against the Romans in AD 66. So this is the final war with Rome, the 64 to 66, due to the abuse of authority. And then when the Romans came in to conquer Jerusalem, this would have, remember, the Romans conquered Jerusalem in AD 70. And if you remember, there was a group of people at Masada that held out for several years after that. So Masada, which is a mountain fortress on the edge of the Dead Sea, didn't fall until AD 73, and the zealots would have been the ones that were holding out there, and it turns out holding out to the death. So that gives you a picture that there were people who were willing to take up arms against Rome. It wasn't a majority, but there were these people around at the time, and a little bit of tie-in here to some of the things that we read in the New Testament. But that's all we know about the zealots. So with that, that kind of closes what I'm going to say about the parties. Are there any questions or comments about that before we move into Jesus' interaction with the parties is what we're going to look at next? Any questions or comments? TJ. So the question is, are there groups today that might still cling to different ones of these views? Not that I know of. The Pharisees are the ones that really survived the destruction of Jerusalem in subsequent events. The zealots probably disappeared because they were crushed and everything fell apart, basically. The Sadducees were also highly invested in the political stability, and so when that political stability disappeared, you know, they didn't really have a reason to continue either. They weren't popular with the people. So the views of the Pharisees and the Essenes probably were the ones that predominated in coming down, you know, the legacy of these groups down to the present day. You know, the present-day Jew, you know, they study the scriptures. They also study the tradition. That really comes down from the Pharisees. So a lot of the rabbinical literature and interpretation of the scriptures and things like that that become almost as high of authority as the scriptures themselves or of equal authority with the scriptures. That's probably the common view of the conservative Jews today. And when I say conservative, I don't mean the conservative party, which actually isn't conservative in our eyes, but the ones who would be religiously conservative. There's a lot of variations in Judaism today, just like there are a lot of variations in Christianity. Yeah. Not really, no. Daniel. The question is, would the zealots be looking for this messianic conqueror? Or maybe did they even see themselves as part of that movement? And we know from Qumran that the Qumran people believed that they were living in the last days, in the days when the Messiah was going to come, however they understood that. We talked about that earlier. There were a lot of different views of what Messiah meant, but it's very possible that the zealots, the religiously conservative zealots, might have been influenced by that type of thinking as well, this sort of apocalyptic thinking. This is the end of the age, and we need to, you know, expel the Romans and usher in this kingdom age. Okay? All right, well, we've got a few minutes left here, so let's turn to Jesus' interaction with these people, which, of course, there's a lot of information in the New Testament about that. Just to give you a heading check here, we're kind of nearing the end of the course. We'll look at Jesus' interaction here. We are going to look a little bit at the messianic expectations. We've talked about that in the past and sort of what people were looking forward to as in terms of a Messiah. But what we'll do is we'll take some of those ideas and then look specifically at some of the things that come out of the New Testament with respect to what people were looking for in the Messiah. And then that'll pretty much be the end of the course there. When Jesus comes on the scene is kind of how we're going to end this. So Jesus' interaction with the sects. So before we even talk about Jesus, let's start with his forerunner, John the Baptist. So in Matthew chapter 3, John the Baptist interacts with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And he, of course, was very critical of both the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So he says here in Matthew chapter 3, When he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to where he was baptizing, he said to them, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the coming wrath? Produce fruit in keeping with repentance. And do not think you can say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father.' I tell you that out of these stones God can raise up children for Abraham. The axe is already at the root of the trees, and every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire." So even before Jesus came on the scene, the Pharisees and the Sadducees had already interacted with John the Baptist, and John the Baptist was very critical of them, basically as being hypocrites and who weren't actually living the way that they were saying that they were living. Then when Jesus came on the scene, we see both the Pharisees and the Sadducees attacking Jesus, often trying to trap him into saying something that would get him in trouble or that they could use against him somehow. That's common for both of the parties. What I did here for this section, of course, there's lots of places you can go, but I had just, at Christmas time, I had just read through the Gospel of Matthew. This time, while I was reading through it, I just jotted down all of the interactions so I didn't have to go to my BibleWorks software and search for Pharisees and Sadducees and Jesus. Just reading through it, I just noted all of the interactions. And so kind of what I'm going to do here is mostly focus on the passages in the Gospel of Matthew. Then there's parallel passages in Mark and Luke, and then there's additional passages that we'll discuss a little bit. But a lot of the references that I'll give here are just right straight from Matthew, because that's how I organize this. So the Pharisees and the Sadducees were often looking for ways to trap Jesus. And we have an example in Matthew chapter 16, verse 1, where both parties came together to test Jesus by asking him for a sign. You might remember that. In this case, we see the Pharisees and the Sadducees acting together to try to trap Jesus. The Sadducees tried to trap him on the resurrection. You know that passage well, where they try to pose this dilemma for him that is unanswerable because, you know, this guy had all these wives, and whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection? Of course, their purpose is to say, there isn't any resurrection. How can there be? It doesn't make any sense, right? And Jesus tells them that they're in error and don't know the scriptures. And then the Pharisees, more often than the Sadducees, confronted, tested, and opposed Jesus. And I'm not going to read through all these. We're going to look at some specific examples, but let's see. Just from the Gospel of Matthew here, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I've got 10 instances just from the Gospel of Matthew where the Pharisees were either attacking him, confronting him, or testing him in some way. And those can be multiplied with other examples, I'm sure, and as well as from the other Gospels. Now, Jesus does seem to have disputed much more with the Pharisees than the Sadducees. I don't know if you've noticed that when you read through the Bible, but why is that? Well, why do you think it would be? Anybody? They're worse? I don't know if they're worse. They were the ones in power. They were the ones in power? They were adding to the law. That's a good point. Yeah. There were more of them. That's what I'm looking for. So where was Jesus? Where was Jesus most of the time in his ministry? He wasn't actually in the temple that often. He was in the synagogues. He was in the villages. He was in the towns. He was around Galilee most of the time, in the territory of Galilee. Well, who was in the towns? Are the Sadducees hanging out in the towns and in the synagogues? No. They're in the temple. They're the priestly nobility. Most likely, the Pharisees were rubbing shoulders with Jesus every day. And we know, like, we have the examples where, remember the time when the disciples were walking through the grain field and picking grain on the Sabbath? The Pharisees were with them. Okay, the Pharisees were following Jesus around. Remember, Jesus was a rabbi. The Pharisees were in that school of teachers of the law and very interested in disputing and asking questions about the law. So they would have probably been naturally also following Jesus around to hear what he was saying and to weigh what he was saying against the scriptures and their tradition. So probably the reason that Jesus disputed so much with the Pharisees is because that's who he was mainly rubbing shoulders with on a day-to-day basis. That confirms what Josephus tells us about the Pharisees being very popular with the common people, because they were living with them, and they were really had come from the ranks of the common people. They weren't the priestly nobility like the Sadducees from the wealthy families. So That's most likely why Jesus interacted much more with the Pharisees. Okay, we're going to look at specific criticisms, particularly of the Pharisees. But before we do that, we'll look at the general criticisms that Jesus offers. This is criticisms of both parties. So one of the things that he tells his disciples and the people is to be on guard against the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So in Matthew chapter 16, I'll just read what he says there, a couple verses. In verse 6, he says, this is the time when, if you remember, this the context of these statements is when the disciples had forgot to bring bread, you remember? He says, "Be careful," Jesus said to them, "be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees," which is something that the disciples didn't immediately figure out. They thought, well, he must be talking about the fact that we forgot to bring the bread. Okay, but then later in verse 11, he says, "How is it that you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread? But be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." Then they understood that he was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So Jesus was teaching his disciples and the people to watch out for what the Pharisees and the Sadducees were teaching. And then one other example of the general criticisms is in Matthew 21. Jesus here gives a number of parables that are related to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He gives two parables, one about the two sons, the one who said he wasn't going to go work, but then later did go and do the job, and the one who said he was going to do it and didn't do it, and Jesus asked, which one of these is the one who did what his father wanted? And then we have the parable of the vineyard and the tenants. And you know that story about how the owner of the vineyard sent his servants and then finally his son. Well, we know that the chief, it says right here in verse 45, the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables and they knew he was talking about them. So here, the chief priests now, remember, that's likely Sadducees. Think Sadducees when you hear that, and the Pharisees. So the Pharisees and the Sadducees are together here, and Jesus is telling parables really against the religious establishment. And then immediately following that passage, we have the parable of the wedding banquet. Remember how that one goes. All these people are invited to the great wedding banquet. None of the people who are invited want to come to the banquet. So the people that end up coming are the ones off the streets, the beggars and the poor people. Well, what's the message of that parable? In the context here, it's that the religious rulers, the ones who are invited, rejected the invitation to enter the kingdom. And, you know, Jesus talks about, I think it's actually in the same area right in here, where he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you've killed the prophets." You know, basically you're rejecting the kingdom. You're rejecting your Messiah. What he's saying in these three parables is the religious establishment will not enter the kingdom. Think about how radical that was to the people that were listening to him. You know, the religious establishment were the ones that people looked up to as the religious leaders and authorities. And Jesus is turning everything upside down here and saying, they're not the ones that are following me in their hearts. It's all external behavior. So that was a very radical thing for Jesus to be saying at the time.